Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on D'Arblay Street in Soho W1. One road north of the second killing by the Blackout Ripper. One street west of the pawn robbery by the randy Canadian sailor. A few doors up from the racist attack on Brian Robinson. In the same street as the gentle Garotta. Coming soon to Murder Mile. At 4 D'Arblay Street, on the ground floor of a four-storey Georgian terrace, currently stands Creme, a cookie shop. Only these are not those nasty British biscuit-like splats, which were as flat as roadkill, as hard as tarmac, and blessed with one flavour, sickly sweet. These are big, fat, gooey cookies, thick like muffins and soft like pillows, which melt in the mouth and make you wish the diets didn't exist. Mmm, yummy. Being popular, you'll often see long lines of eager eyes, keen to peep through this curved window, to drool over these gorgeous treats created within. And yet it's hard to stomach the fact that such an abhorrent and brutal crime could ever have been committed, where such sumptuous cookies are lovingly baked. But back in 1856, this was a prosperous tobacconist shop, run by a mother of three, Sarah Boosfield. She worked long hours to support her three children, and many said, also her husband William. A pointless little man who dreamed of fame rather than fulfilling his responsibility as a father and a husband. But what could have driven this quiet little dreamer to slaughter his entire family? My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 228. William Boosfield and the Price of Fame. Everyone has a plan of what they wish their life to be. Some achieve it, others don't. And whereas some may fight to ensure the safety of their loved ones, others will do the unthinkable when their dream drifts out of reach. Sarah was born in Westminster in 1827, the only child of John and Anne Jones. From her father, being a carpenter from South Wales, who ran a successful joinery business and purchased several properties to earn an income as a landlord, he instilled in her a solid work ethic. From her mother, a native of Chelsea, she inherited a sense of love, and described as pleasant, friendly, and affectionate. She had a devotion to her family which would never be split apart. except by tragedy. Sarah had brains and business sense. In an era where a woman's place was solely as a mother, a wife, or if she was a widow and a spinster, to earn a meagre pittance doing menial work. But as the perfect harmony of both parents, alone, she could have done well. But with a big part of her life's dream, to marry and to have children, that part of her dream required a man. And his name was William Bousfield. How and where they met is unknown. But having impressed both Sarah and her parents, he must have played the part of a loyal lover and a future breadwinner well, as they both liked him and loved him. Whether it was all an act, or a role he was willing to play for a time, again, that is unknown. But for the first few years of their marriage, William would perform the part of a husband and father as best that he could. As a native of Marylebone, William's upbringing is mostly unrecorded, as although he was raised with two sisters, he didn't seem to be the epitome of a loyal and loving son, but a boy who exasperated his parents. Described as being of a repulsive aspect, he seemed taller than his 5'8" frame suggested, as his body was as thin as a witch's broom, and his pale face had the hollowed-out features of a ghost. And as a quiet and sullen man, who was often lost in his own thoughts, his conversations were punctuated by the blowing of wind or the puff of his pipe, rather than the words which unraveled the workings of his mind. Since his school years, his baffled parents had attempted to get this idle boy into a profession. First as an errand boy for a tradesman called Mortimer on the Strand, and later as an office boy at a solicitor's, rising to the role of clerk. But raised in the shadow of the blossoming Western theatres, as William yawned over spreadsheets, it wasn't a desk job he yearned for, but to tread the boards. Dubbed by his furious father as a silly little hobby, acting was not seen as an honest career for a decent man by civilized society, but on the same level as whoring oneself out on the street for a few coins. So with William's hopes of being a stage prancer, or God forbid, a singer at his parents' discretion, fearing that the neighbours would ask, "What's wrong with the boy?" his dreams were royally stamped out. In the winter of 1849, William Bousfield married Sarah Jones, becoming Mr. and Mrs. Bousfield. With one of Sarah's dreams fulfilled, and their first child conceived on their wedding night, this was the wake-up call which should have jolted William from his daze and made him the man his family would deserve. But having married without his father's permission, with his parents disowned as an argument ensued, there was no one left to force him to endure a dull job and to hold back his dreams. Or so he thought. On the 16th of December 1849, Anne Eleanor Bousfield was born. As a healthy girl, she was raised in a loving family home by a doting mother and was adored upon by her grandparents, John and Anne. But from her own father, William, sometimes he fed and held her, but little more than that. A neighbour stated,
"He was fond of his children, but not excessively so."
And with the same being said of his love for his wife, in the places where William failed as a husband, Sarah's father had to step in. Described by another neighbour
as a good man who always showed his daughter the most marked kindness and supplied her with everything they required.
Sarah and her children would never suffer any hunger or poverty, even though John would state,
"William hadn't earned a day's wage in years."
William's work ethic was non-existent, as although he had briefly trained as a French polisher, like many of life's dreamers, he'd had his business cards made up, but had no intention of doing the job. Unable to pay the rent, or even a few basic bills, John, Sarah's father, purchased the family a ground floor flat at 4 Darblay Street in Soho, and wisely moved himself and his wife into the flat directly above. As a small practical lodging, it had two purposes. In the back parlour, next to a cast iron fire for cooking and heating, and a warm horsehair bed where William, Sarah and Anne would sleep, they had a place to live, but also out front, a thriving business. Having purchased a tobacconist's, which sold tobacco, pipes and papers as expected, but also the essentials like logs and kindling, with their brood soon to be followed by Eliza in January 1852 and John in July 1855. It was hoped that, given a shop of his own, William could provide for his family an income and become a good father and a loving husband. It was hoped. But hope is a cruel word. Having neglected his business, as much as his role as a breadwinner, being a worthless idle fellow, as his own wife would call him, William and Sarah had frequent fights. And with William unable to provide much, if anything, for this family, although she was a busy mother of 3 children, all under the age of 6, with one still suckling at her breast, Sarah ran the tobacconists. From dawn till dusk, she bathed the kids, she made the meals, she sewed the clothes, and having opened the shop, often with her little ones at her feet when her mother couldn't babysit, she served the customers, she purchased the goods, she earned the money, and she got the babies ready for bed. Her days were long and exhausting, and with their marriage decaying, as William's nights were spent in a fruitless search for the wrong kind of work, Sarah and William had begun to sleep in separate beds. In a last attempt to get William into a job, at around the same time, Sarah's father had purchased him a set of workman's tools, including a chisel. Made of iron, with a wooden handle, and an unblemished cutting edge, sharp enough to sever the hardest grain. It was a chisel William would use only once to end the life of his wife. At this point, it would be expected that William's descent into multiple murder would be preceded by a spiral of drink, depression, and rage. Only with no history of insanity, William was not a violent drunk or a drug addict, but a sullen man who was fixated on one thing, his dream of becoming an actor. During the first part of the winter of 1855, a winter so cold it was dubbed the Great Frost. William was working on a paltry wage of 5 shillings a week at the Princess's Theatre at 150 Oxford Street. That year, he performed in a pantomime. Only as neither a gifted actor, nor being quite taciturn, too quiet to project his voice, his name was not on the poster. Billed as a young man, William was little more than a background artiste, whose silent performance was there to add colour to each scene. He had no lines except for what he mimed, and he had no purpose except to add a dash of window dressing. By January, with a newly built Royal Opera House in Covent Garden opening, William got work as a silent set filler for Professor Anderson, the infamous magician billed as the Wizard of the North. As a polite young man, he didn't chat with his fellow thespians. As a boy, he didn't fraternize with any of the dancers. And as an actor, he wasn't the best, as with his performance described as lacking energy, he found it difficult even to smoke authentically on set, even though he smoked at home. With a show every evening, plus a matinee every Wednesday and Saturday, although busy but earning a pittance, the only time he saw his wife and children was in bed or in the tobacconist's shop, where as a charming young woman who was bright, chatty, and knew that the best way to keep her mostly male customers coming back was to engage them in a bit of banter, he didn't like the role that she played. Taught by her father, who was a shrewd businessman, Sarah knew to be polite and professional. She knew how to be friendly without being too familiar. And she knew how to be flirtatious as a striking young woman. But as a loyal mother dedicated to her 3 children, that's all it would ever be. It was only through his simmering jealousy that William was ever seen working in the shop, to act as a barrier between the wife he claimed to love and the customers he had learned to loathe. When in truth, it was they who would rather be served by her than by him. Saturday the 2nd of February 1856 was an unremarkable day, as the only bitterness in the air was the biting wind as the great frost lingered on. And with snow underfoot, all manner of feet precariously walked. At breakfast, they argued as they often did, but it was nothing out of the ordinary. And being Saturday, between his matinee performance and the evening show, William made his moody presence known in the shop, as a slew of young tradesmen came in to buy tobacco and to attempt to flirt with his wife. At 7:30 p.m, a witness heard them quarrelling over Sarah being improper, stating,
"I had not the slightest idea if it was anything more serious than usual."
And having made up, they went about their jobs. If those few bickering words had been the spark which had ignited his rage and left 4 innocents dead, then his actions that followed and his performance at the theatre would have been off. Only it wasn't. He played his role. He fetched some milk, and through the snow, he walked back home to 4 D'Arblay Street. At 10:30 p.m, John saw William in the back parlour. With 6-year-old Anne asleep in their bed, and 4-year-old Eliza snuggled up beside her, as William bounced their restless 8-month-old son John on his knee. He was said to be calm and cheerful. As the dawn chorus broke and the church bell struck 7, with an odd calmness, William walked a 10-minute walk from his home to Bow Street Police Station. Described as sober, yet distressed, when PC Fudge asked why he was here, William simply said,
"To give myself up. I have murdered my wife."
Pleading for the PC to kill him and to ease his pain, although an inch-long wound had been slit across his throat and a second was still flowing freely from a slash to his left wrist, not all of the blood was his. Across his aghast face, down his gulping throat, over his once white shirt, and with a thick red goo dried into crusts on his shivering hands, he wasn't delusional when he gave them his address. Just distraught. Accompanied by PC Fudge, as the carriage carrying Inspector Dodd drove into D'Arblay Street, he was shocked to see that this road was so quiet. As still silently sleeping, a crowd hadn't been roused by the murder. With the door locked, Inspector Dodd knocked, waking what he thought was the first floor lodger.
Who are you? What is this racket?
As unaware that the Welshman was the victim's father, Inspector Dodd bluntly stated,
"Police, a murder has been committed in the back parlour."
Startling him awake. Unbolting the parlour door, along the shop's stone floor lay spots of dried blood as a line of handprints daubed the walls with red smears. In his agony, John called out, "Sarah!
Sarah!
Sarah!" But he got no reply. With the candles dead and the shutters drawn, the room was dark. With the fire out and a howling wind, it was deathly cold. And with no life heard, in the bed lay a silent lump under a woolen sheet. Touching his daughter's pale and bloodied face, his fingers knew instantly that she was dead, as not a breath rose from her bloody body, nor steam from the deep long wound which had ripped open her neck. James Hadaway, a surgeon from Berwick Street, examined her body in situ, stating,
"It had divided the skin and all of the soft parts down to the 4th and 5th vertebrae and splitting the carotid artery."
Inflicted using a razor, this initial wound had occurred as she slept. Only her other wounds were more hateful.
"There had been an intention to bleed this woman to death, with 3 cuts to her left elbow, which had bifurcated the artery, and 2 to the right. These were made to open the veins.
But with the heart found empty of blood, instead he stabbed her in the face, as to deface her in death." For John, aside from the tragedy of losing his daughter, was the irony that she'd been murdered with a tool he had brought William to help him find work. As on the pillow lay the chisel drenched in blood. With the bedsheets dishevelled and her blood splattered up the walls, what concerned Inspector Dodd was why she had no defensive wounds upon her. In the last 2 minutes she had lived, She had fought for her life, only with her nails intact, no fingers broken, and no slashes to her hands. Why didn't she fight back? And yet it was as he moved her slowly stiffening body that he realized the reason why. As a good mother, a loving woman, and her children's sole protector, as William's razor slit a 4-inch long wound across her throat, and her bloodied airways gasped and gagged for even an ounce of oxygen, her only thought was to protect her babies. And although she had shielded them as best that she could, Anne, age 6, Eliza, age 4, and John, who was only 8 months old, had all had their throats slit. With the inquest held at St. James's Workhouse, so feverish were the locals to see justice that the boardroom was full, the street was crammed with crowds, and the police had officers guarding the house. Paid for by a deluge of public donations, with Poland Street impassable, a series of black, horse-drawn carriages lined up at the back of the workhouse morgue on Defour's Place. Weeping and furious, as the crowds jostled nearer, suddenly a hushed silence descended over the people as through the doors, 4 coffins emerged in ever-decreasing sizes. With one so small, a single pallbearer held it in his arms. Sarah, Anne, Eliza and John were all buried in a single grave in West Brompton Cemetery. His trial at the Old Bailey was a mere formality. As declared sane, his guilt was evident. And described as a most dreadful character, although there was an absence of motive, he was sentenced to death. Throughout, he was said to be overwhelmed with grief. Upon hearing his sentence, it is said that he nearly fainted and had to be removed by a jailer. From Newgate Prison, he callously wrote a letter to Sarah's grieving father, blaming her murder on her alleged adultery. And with his appeal denied, on Saturday the 29th of March at 4 p.m, just one day before his execution, he attempted to take his own life. According to the turnkey, whilst he sat in bed, staring intently at the fire, he threw himself headfirst into the grate. As the flame scorched his hair, the hot coals seared his skin, and as the room stunk of burning flesh, his face became a mass of bubbling wounds, which popped and spat like hot fat. But having been rescued within seconds, his fate wouldn't be decided in this room, but at the gallows. Therefore it's odd that for William, whose deadly dream was to become an actor, that he would fail to realise that his greatest performance was yet to come. On Sunday the 30th of March 1856, at 6 a.m, he rose from his prison bed. He had his wounds bathed, and with his last request being a little wine for breakfast, the sheriff, the reverend and the governor came to collect him.
only William, unless he was faking, was not well. As held to a chair by two aides, with one wiping a frothy liquid from his mouth, he appeared to be in a dying state, and his limbs refused to work. Whether this was a symptom of his burns, a cunning ploy, or just plain cowardliness, we shall never know. But although the doctor declared his pulse was low, but his arteries were active, with his face still red, blistered and swollen, although he was described as an appalling sight, his execution was imminent. At 8 a.m., having been carried to the scaffold by four men, with two at his arms and two at his legs, with a hemp noose around his scorched neck, which still bled from his tender burns, the Reverend read from the burial service. The prison bell rang its deathly toll, and the 5,000-strong crowd fell silent. Only his death wouldn't be a quick and kindly act of compassion. As with William Calcraft, famed as an executioner, who, like William, was a showman, seeing these executions as a form of entertainment rather than an act of punishment, as the crowd sat supping their beers, he would wow them with his cruelty. So with his hands and legs tied, as Calcraft removed the bolt, Boosfield dropped. Only he didn't fall a few feet as his neck snapped, but mere inches as his throat was strangled. Seeing his body twisting and flinching in pained agony, as his body weight pulled on his neck, the crowd roared with glee as the man dangled. And although it took most men several minutes to die, the show was not over. As having somehow swung his feet up, as William secured himself precariously on the scaffold, the crowd cheered. Seeing his act of rebellion, Calcraft kicked his legs so the strangling could continue, and at that, the crowd booed. And so it went on. For several minutes, William swinging his legs up and Calcraft kicking them off. Upon his fourth attempt at trying to save his skin, and a full 10 minutes into his torture, as William exhaustedly stood there, wobbling on a slim slip of wood, with the crowd growing ever restless as his protracted agony descended from a bit of harmless fun into an act of wanton cruelty, keen to end it quick and to appease the turning masses, Calcraft threw himself at William's legs, and with his 16 stone of weight, he hung off them. As for the next few minutes, William's body was gripped in a convulsive twitch, until suddenly, he went very still. Buried in an unmarked grave inside Newgate Prison, the last sound he probably heard was the applause of the crowd, which marked the curtain call of William Boosfield.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Oh, holy, holy moly, 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 pudding and pie. Go take your little hat off. There we go. Oh, dear. Just fighting to get that one done. Only because I'm in an area where loads of gooses love to hang out. They love to hang out. And there's normally like about 100 gooses here, but there's almost none today. But I can hear them in the background. They're on their way. And I can hear them going, getting nearer and nearer. It's like, oh, you little bastards. And above me is all the little parakeets as well. It's pointless little green parakeets that spend their life going, eh, eh, making horrible bloody noises, little bastards. Oh, I don't agree with hunting, but those little parakeets, just get rid of them. What's the point to them? They shouldn't be here anyway. Ooh, bloody foreigners coming over here with their green wings. So there we go, folks. Hope you enjoyed that episode. If indeed you can enjoy an episode about a pointless little man who murdered his entire family. What a horrible story. Hold on, I'm just going to open the window a bit. I'm going to open the window a bit. I'm going to pop on my water with my tea that's ready. Oh, it looks very lovely outside. Nice and warm, except I'm going to be in the coffee shop editing the... spending hours and hours to get rid of all the pops and clicks and horrible sounds in the audio. Oh, anyway. Oh, welcome to Extra Mile. So I've been away a while, haven't I? Unscripted, unedited bit. What day are we on now? 26th of September. So technically you don't know that I'm back because I've already done the next few two episodes before I left to go to France, but now I'm back from France. So even though you won't be hearing this till middle of October, I'm in the past. Whoa, look at me, I'm in the past. Let me tell you what's going on in the past. It's pretty much the same as the future. Our politicians are all shit. They're doing a crap job, as they always do. It's what they do, isn't it? Anyway, just got back from France. It was very nice. Weather was good for about 4 days and shit for 2 days. I think I brought all the shit weather with me. But it was very nice. Got to see my dad and my stepmom. I haven't seen them in about a year, which was nice. A little bit burnt, which was good because the weather was good at times. So I sat there vegging out. I did nothing. I didn't take any laptop with me. I didn't do anything. It was very good. And then I sat there getting a bit sunburned and drinking Leffe Ruby. So I think over here we only seem to have regular Leffe and Leffe Brun, which is a bit of a madman. But over there they got Leffe Ruby. I think we can get it in some places here, and it's got a kind of a nice cherry flavour to it. It's very nice. It's very nice. So I enjoyed that. And got very sunburned and did lots of walking. Just because they're in the middle of nowhere, and the problem is you have to drive everywhere. Like, even to the nearest village you have to drive, and I don't like that. I'm just like, yeah, okay, there's a little village 7 miles away. I'll happily do like a 7 mile journey there and back. So 15 miles just to go and pick up a pastry, even though the pastry shop would be shut. So lots of exercise, but lots of really good places to eat. That's the thing I found fascinating about France is I'm only really used to Paris and places like that. But in kind of middle of nowhere, even like we walked into a place that looked like a trucker's stop. And the food in there was exceptional. Like the food came out, I was expecting slop on a plate. And it was like delicious three-course meals that were exquisitely designed. And you just go, wow, this is not what I was expecting. Can I have my herbal tea? Here we go. So that was all good. Yeah, really good food. Went to see a cave. A cave full of crystals, that was really interesting, except when we went in there they give us headset because we're English and the tour guide was in French, and the lady did say, she said, we're having a bit of problems with this at the moment, so hopefully it will work. It didn't work. We got the first 2 minutes, and then basically occasionally it would cut in on unimportant bits, and like we realized the bits that we would get like would be about 3 minutes long, and then the tour guide would do a bit for the French people which was about 15 minutes long with lots of jokes in it as well because they're all laughing. So yeah, we had no idea what was going on, but it was very nice we did that. So yes, so I'm back here now, back in good old United Kingdom. There we go. I hope it hasn't cocked up anymore since I left. It was shit when I was leaving. It's probably still shit now, isn't it? So what's going on? Just quickly, thank you to new Patreon subscribers. So thank you to Teresa, Michelle Cressida, and Robin Howell. So thank you, Teresa, Michelle, and Robin. Thank you so much for becoming Patreon subscribers, of course. You get lots of goodies in there, lots of goodies that I don't share anywhere else. You get exclusive Walk With Me series. I think there's like 160 episodes of that so far. So you can enjoy all those. And when I'm away researching, I do Walk With Me. So you get updates on what's happening with the future episodes and all things like that. You also get video and ebooks, and there's lots of goodies in there. It's all lovely stuff. So yes. If you're new, don't forget, if you're new to Extra Mile, this is the unscripted, unedited bit, obviously. And we're going to do a quiz shortly. We're going to do some extra stuff found in the episode as well. So if you ever came on the ill-fated, now-gone Murder Mile walks, you'll slightly recognise this story. This was one of the stories I used to tell on the walk, but I never did it in the podcast. Same as William Creese, I never did them because I was like, well, you know, I don't want people coming on the walk going, oh, I've already heard that story. But now I don't do the walks anymore. I decided to tell the William Boosfield story in full. So there you go. Of course, if you want a little bit of a factoid to go with this, where did we get the word hangover from? It's that final scene that we get the word hangover from, which is because it was a public spectacle and people were executed in public, and it was meant to be as a deterrent, but people, it was like kind of X Factor today. People would turn up and they want to see people punished and they want to see people abused. Therefore, they'd turn up and they'd have a great time and go, oh, I loved it. It's great fun. I'm a moron. So, people would turn up to executions. It would be a family event. They'd bring picnics with them. They'd bring beer. And that's where the phrase to be hungover comes from, is that in the morning, many people would get really pissed and watch the executions because it wasn't just the execution. It was like an all-day event. You got singers and dancers and all that shit going on. And, you know, you get really drunk. And then in the morning, people would wake up with a sore head. And therefore, it was dubbed a hangover. There you go. Oh, lots of useful facts. Well done, Michael. Well done. So I'm going to do you some quiz questions and then we'll dive into some extra stuff about this episode. So it was just nice to do this episode in full because obviously on the tour, I only really had 4 or 5 minutes to do each bit. So you had to kind of gloss over a lot and, you know, I couldn't tell things in full. But the whole point about this was to get a chance to get everything into it. So here we go. Question number one. Don't forget, I haven't edited this episode yet. So I may edit out the bit that this question relates to. Question number one. What is the name of the shop at 4 Darblay Street today? So 4 Darblay Street today, what is the name of the shop? Question number 2. Where was Sarah's father from? Question number 3. Where was Sarah's mother from? Question number 4. What was... Question number 4. What was Sarah's maiden name? Question number 5. William was born in what part of London? Question number 6. What height was William? Question number 7. What was the name of the tradesman William worked for on the Strand? Question number 8. Except as an errand boy and a clerk, what job had William briefly trained as? Question number 9. What tool did John buy for William? And question number 10. The winter of 1855 was known as what? So there you go. I'm just going to close over this window a bit because the sunlight is really streaming in. Oh, right. Okie cokie. Pig in a pokey. Let's do this. So, William being an actor. I mean, he wasn't really an actor. They called him a... they said he worked as a young man, which is one step higher than a supernumeracy. And a supernumeracy actors were usually character actors in operas or ballets, or in his case, his pantomimes, who would train under professional direction to create a believable scene, and they would earn about 5 shillings a week. Basically, glorified background artist, really. Don't forget, this isn't in films. This, where you have a big set, this is on a stage, so relatively small. We don't know much about his career because he wasn't billed, therefore he doesn't really appear anywhere. But he did join the Princess's Theatre up until the Christmas at 150 Oxford Street. So if you're walking along Oxford Street up round Soho area and you see where Sports Direct is, that is where the Princess's Theatre used to be. Obviously around this time we've got the Covent Garden Theatre. This is kind of an interesting time for William around this time because it was the Theatres Act of 1843 had broken up. So originally there was a monopoly on theatres, but now it was kind of anyone could kind of really run a theatre at that point. So a lot of new ones started to open up. And obviously the Covent Garden Theatre was originally the Royal Italian Opera House. That had gone through a couple of changes. It also burnt down. Just prior to that, I can't remember the dates of that. So it had just been remodeled. It was just opening up. There was a new show coming in, and this was going to be Professor Anderson, the Wizard of the North. I'm sure I've got some extra details here about Professor Anderson. Where is he? Where are you? John Henry Anderson, his name was, an infamous magician. There are a couple of pages online about that because he was relatively well known of his day. So almost spilt my tea then. Quite a decent show to be a part of, but William wasn't exactly a huge part of it. In fact, Professor Anderson, his show, he was in so a year before. Coop being a pain in the arse outside. A year before, this was meant to be his farewell show, and he'd gone up to Aberdeen and he did a farewell show. And apparently, the show was such a success that it actually inspired him to not do a farewell show. It's kind of like Elton John, isn't it? His farewell, no, not farewell show. So he would do, he decided to do a much larger performance, and he did one at the Lyceum, which is a big theatre here. And then at the Covent Garden as well. Unfortunately, where is it here? He played a show at the Lyceum in London and then moved to Covent Garden. But that year, after one of his performances, the theatre caught fire, destroying all of Anderson's properties and bankrupting him for the second time in his professional career. So there you go. Don't be a magician, folks. Can't talk. My brain has gone. So let's dive into some stuff about William. His jealousy. See, what it seems to be is that his wife seems to be very professional at her job. Do you know, obviously, if you're going to, you run a shop, half of it is to have good stuff to sell, but also half the battle really is to kind of be the kind of person that people want to come and get stuff from. If you get stuff from a shop and the stuff's good, but the person behind the counter is an asshole, you just can't be. Oh, you just think, oh, I'd rather not. Whereas if it's a nice person and you have a good chat with them and you get on well with them and their stuff's good and the, you know, it's not too expensive, you think, yeah, I'm definitely going to come back. I think that's half the battle. I don't think William understood that. He was a bit obsessed with himself and obsessed with becoming an actor, whereas she was, you know, raised by a father who was a good businessman. He ran a joinery and a carpentry firm. He owned quite a few houses. So they weren't well off, but he was the kind of person always investing, always thinking. And this is an era where a lot of people didn't have bank accounts as well. So, you know, she learnt a lot from him and she knew how to work. It's weird, isn't it? Because like as William being an actor, he should have learnt how to work an audience. And that's what she's doing, is she's working the customers. She knows how to get the most out of them to get her to like her and then to come back. You know, simple things, being polite. But he's just so jealous of her that it really shatters apart their relationship. It really does. That particular day, Mrs. Bennett, I think she lived on the second floor, said they often had words, meaning a bit of an argument. Every now and then, occasionally. This was mostly because he could not provide for the children. What does seem to be a possible link towards the motive there is he seemed to be more jealous and upset on Saturdays. So Saturdays are the days, one of the 2 days, because Wednesdays as well. Saturdays, he would do matinee performances and an evening show. So he was away from the house more than that. But because she was a considerate tobacconist, what she would do is for the local tradesmen, she would give them credit on their tobacco. And then, so like they could come and get their tobacco, she'd mark it in like a book. And then on a Saturday, they would come in and pay off their monies. So on Saturdays, when he wasn't there that much, she would have a lot of young men coming in, talking to her. She would be polite to them. They would come in and pay off their money. So he didn't seem to like that. Apparently at 5:30 p.m. he overheard his wife talking improper with a 16-year-old boy who worked at the neighbouring pianoforte manufacturer. And that manufacturer is literally corner of Darblay Street and Wardour Street. It's like two doors down. Again, she was just being pleasant and not inappropriate, but he, you know, he's a jealous man. He didn't see that. At 7:30 p.m., a supernumerary, so someone who was just below him in the theatre, who knew Sarah and William well and lived local, was in the shop. William and Sarah were quarrelling, and he said, as was always the case whenever he entered the house, they were arguing. I had not the slightest idea that there was anything more serious than usual. So they were arguing. People knew they were arguing. They had a tendency to argue, but it wasn't a huge big fight. It was just, you know, couples bickering, as happens. You know, it never got physical. That evening he performed his part at a pantomime. They would say a pantomime. It was actually the musical show at the Covent Garden Theatre. Everyone who worked with him said nothing really extraordinary happened. He kind of did his job and he went home. As mentioned in the episode, do you know, John Jones, Sarah's father, saw him with one of the children, believed to be John, bouncing him on his knee. She gone out to get some butter. Everything seemed fine. Do you know, they had a couple of arguments that night, but nothing really major. Nothing out of the ordinary happened that night. But it is said that for the first time in 8 months, so it was around the time of the birth of their last child that things really went south. Things really went bad really quickly. That was the first night that really he had slept in the same bed as her and the children. We don't know whether they were making up or whether things were better. They still seem to be arguing, so we don't really know. I'm having a swig out of my Blackout Ripper mug. There you go. What else we got? I didn't put this in the episode because it slows it down, but between midnight and 1 a.m, Mrs. Bennett, so Mary Ann Bennett, who's a widow on the second floor at one of the lodges, she went down to get a bundle, two bundles of firewood, which she knocked on the parlour door. So even though they're asleep, I don't think they're asleep at that point. I think they're still talking or whatever. Sarah answered it, stating, "We're in bed." Sarah called to her husband to get her to give her a bundle of wood and said, "Will you rise to get it?" Sarah spoke in a cheerful tone but muttered a few words which I could not hear. Mrs. Bennett said, "Mrs. Boothfield said in the most cheerful voice, 'I will leave it at your door at 6 o'clock in the morning.'" So someone, one of the neighbours dropped by at about midnight, 1 a.m, went to get a bundle of wood. Maybe this was a regular thing that she did, you know. But yeah, said there didn't seem to be a problem. But no one throughout the next, so between 1 a.m. and 7 a.m. when he went to the police station, no one heard anything. So even her parents, who were one floor above, heard nothing as well. You know, there was no crying, there was no shouting, no argument at all. As far as everyone is concerned, they all went to bed, them and the children. Let's have a look. So he goes to Bow Street Police Station. PC Alfred Fudge. I always used to enjoy saying that on the tours I used to do. PC Fudge. Because it's always a little giggle before you get into the sadness of the story. He arrived there. As mentioned in the episode, PC Fudge said, "Where are you going?" William said, "In here." PC said, "What for?" William said, "To give myself up. I have murdered my wife." Inspector Dodd, who was the inspector at Bow Street Police Station, said William was the most perfect calmness and composure, even though he stated he had murdered his wife. He said, Dodd said, "I did not think he was intoxicated. He was in a very distressed state. He was searched and a latchkey was found." They did actually check him as best as they could in that era. Obviously, they couldn't do blood tests, but they would kind of smell his breath, and there was no hint of alcohol on his breath. He seemed agitated, but he didn't seem delusional. You know, there's nothing really. I hinted at this in the episode. I haven't put it too much in there. Inspector Dodd noticed a wound near William's jugular vein, as if he had attempted to destroy himself, and his left hand was also covered in blood. The wound was not a severe one, he stated, only an inch long. It appeared to have been to have severed the skin. His hand was bleeding considerably. Inspector Dodd said, "It did not appear to be a very severe wound. It appeared to be about an inch long. It had not separated any veins. It appeared to have gone through the skin. It looked like a very clean wound." Also, when they removed his jacket as well, they realised that one of his shirt sleeves was missing. This was heavily blooded, and they would find that shirt sleeve under the bed later on. I didn't put that in the episode because the connection of it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense whether he'd ripped it off himself to kind of, maybe he'd ripped it off himself to kind of stem the blood flow to the wound to his neck or his hand. We don't know. So I didn't put that in. Let's die. Barking dog. Woo woo. Random dogs just barking for no reason. As they do. At least I'm not recording, which is good. Well, I am recording this, but this bit's fine. I don't mind dogs barking during this bit. It's just the other bit. Let's go down to do you know what? I'm going to ruin one of the quiz. I've already ruined one of the quiz questions a little bit earlier. So if you spotted that, I try not to draw attention to it. I'm going to have to ruin one of the other ones now because I need to draw attention to this. So why is that dog having a bark? There was a cat on my boat earlier on, just sat there in my bow, just like a tabby, just staring at me. Didn't want to come in, which was good. And then would just lick itself and then bugger off. It's what they do, isn't it? Thank you for licking your genitals on my boat. Maybe I'm just jealous. So the weapon itself was a 5/8 chisel, 5 inches long and 1/8 inch in breadth. This was found on the bed pillow with Sarah. The blood on it was still slightly wet, and there was a shaving razor, which was William's, which was broken. Both were smeared with blood, and the chisel left a jagged wound. So that's how they were able to know which weapon was used on which parts of the body. So with Sarah, it was the razor that was used to slit her throat. Most likely that was the first one. And then the chisel was used for the wounds for the elbows, so the veins, but also the wounds to her face as well. Inspector Dodd said there was a great quantity of clotted blood between the dead bodies on the bed and a great quantity of blood on the floor. I traced the blood from the side of the French bedstead across the shop. There was a great deal of blood about the shop. So it doesn't look like he moved the bodies, but what it does look like is that he certainly tried to kill himself at some point, or at least make it look like he was trying to kill himself. So that's most likely where the blood across the shop came from, but it's unlikely that the bodies were moved. We really don't know what happened between that 1 o'clock and the 7 o'clock. So it would have taken him about 15 minutes to get to the police station. We don't know when they were murdered. It was certainly a couple of hours more because the bodies were cold or cooling. But let's not forget, it was an incredibly cold winter. The fire was off at that point, so they would have been cold. But obviously cooling at a faster rate. So we don't know what happened. There doesn't seem to have been a struggle. Dodd said the bedclothes were in a very confused state. As mentioned, under the bed was his shirt sleeve, completely saturated with blood. What else we got? Let's go to what the surgeon said. On glancing at the wound at the woman's throat and then at the chisel, Dr. James Hadaway stated it was his opinion that the murder had been committed with one or two weapons. It would be two weapons eventually. It was evident. It appeared that there had been an evident intention to bleed the woman to death before other wounds were inflicted. He also said Mrs. Boothford was quite dead. Well done, doctor. With an incision on the right side of her neck, about 4 inches long. There were 2 incisions on the right arm and 3 on the left, made for the purpose of opening the veins, but very little blood flowed from them. A puncture wound to the left cheek, an inch from the corner of the mouth, and a lacerated wound to the right side of the lower lip. The wound on the neck was a clean incised one, so that's the one that would have been done using the razor, dividing the skin and all the soft parts down to the 4th and 5th vertebrae and splitting the ligaments. So relatively heavily done, but don't forget, everything you've got in the front of your throat is quite soft and easy to kind of cut through with a knife, whereas anything, when you go down to the spine, that's pretty hard. So splitting the ligaments, the carotid artery was clearly divided. There was a clean cut through the nightdress of her left shoulder, 3 cuts at the bend of the elbow, which had bifurcated the artery, and on her right arm, 2 inches above the bend of the elbow. There were no wounds to her hands or her arms, except obviously the ones intentionally done. Her heart was empty of blood, and the division of the carotid artery was deemed to be the cause of the death. There was no struggle. That was a moorhen you just heard shouting outside. There was no struggle. It's likely that that first wound was inflicted in her sleep, so the one that slit across her throat, that of course would have woken her up, but unable to call out. The doctor said death would have occurred within 2 minutes. There was no sign of chloroform, laudanum, or any sleeping agent that had been used. And with the children, it's kind of uncertain whether the children were in bed with her at the time. It was likely. The children didn't cry out, not that anyone could hear. So we're uncertain whether he had also murdered the children whilst they slept. I think that's more likely, and it's likely also that he probably went oldest to youngest as well. So Anne first, who was 6, found 2 incisions on the right hand side of her neck and 1 on the left, either of which would have been sufficient to cause death. Eliza, the middle child, who was 4, had a deep incision and another a little below the collarbone, between 1 inch and 1.5 inches deep. She was kind of the other side of the bed, so her head at the foot of the bed with one of her legs hanging off the side of the bed. And John, who was just 8 months old, had a deep incision and possibly a slight one on the other side. But there was so much blood by that point, obviously everyone else had bled, that they were unable to ascertain exactly what had caused his death. The blade of the razor was found underneath John, but it was broken at that point as well. The handle was found just underneath Mrs. Boothfield, so Sarah, and the blade itself underneath John. Bodies were removed to St. James's Workhouse on Poland Street. So if you're on Darblay Street, on one side you've got Wardour Street, and that's where the pianoforte guy was. And on the other side of Darblay Street, which is only, you could walk it in about 30 seconds. The other side is Poland Street, so they can actually see the workhouse, St. James's Workhouse, from their house, and that's where the inquest would be held, and that's where the bodies were kept in the morgue as well. Let's just see what else we've got to do. I don't want to go too far and over on this one. I think that's it. I've already given you kind of everything to do with his execution as well. So the trial was held at the Old Bailey on the 6th of March, 1856, between Mr. Justice Earle and Justice Reitman. Justice Reitman said, "This is a case of a most dreadful character, and there will be no doubt that the lives of four persons had been destroyed by the prisoner. However dreadful and horrible the case might be, yet the justice of the country demanded that we should all perform their duty on such a matter, and I must confess that I could not suggest any reasonable grounds for doubting the prisoner had committed the act with which he had been charged." His defence counsel, William's defence counsel, were at a loss as to what to say. They couldn't offer anything. They couldn't offer insanity. They said there was an absence of motive. He never said why he did what he did. The jury almost immediately returned with a verdict and asked if there was any reason why the death sentence should not be applied. They gave no answer. Death sentence was passed. The prisoner appeared overwhelmed with grief during the whole trial and never once looked up at any stage. He was removed from the bar in a fainting condition. And I think that is it. We've done the execution, so I'm not going to go into more about that. But obviously, as you know, Calcraft, horrible man, horrible man. Thank God we had people like Pierpoint years later who gave a more merciful death as opposed to turning it into a big old spectacle, which Calcraft did. So let's go and do the quiz questions and then we're done. So don't forget, I've given you two of these. Any more? No, I've given you two of these. So you've got two for free. There you go. Well done. But I haven't edited this episode yet, so I may edit some of these questions out. So, but not out of here, because I don't edit extra well. There you go. Right. Question number one. What is the name of the shop at 4 Darblay Street today? It's called Creme. Question number two. Where was Sarah's father from?
All right, but
he was from South Wales. In it. Question number three. Where was Sarah's mother from? She's from Chelsea. Question number four. What was Sarah's maiden name? Actually, I gave away that one, didn't I? So technically, you got three. You should have a minimum of three. It was Jones.
Jones.
Question number five. William was born in what part of London? It was Marylebone. Question number six. What height was William? He was 5'8". Question number seven. What was the name of the tradesman William worked for on the Strand? It was Mortimer. Question number nine. Oh, sorry. Question number eight. Except as an errand boy and a clerk, what job had William briefly trained as? Oh, hiccups. A French polisher. Question number nine. What tool did John buy for William? I gave you that one, so that was a chisel. Question number 10. The winter of 1855 was known as what? It was the Great Frost. So there you go. There you go, folks. I'm going to head off and edit this now. Oh, it'll take me a couple of days. Oh, if only I decided to be lazy and just do a lazy podcast rather than slogging my guts out. Hope you enjoyed that. If you can enjoy that kind of episode, next week, another one-parter. I can't remember what it is. We'll find out. Anyway, thank you for supporting the show. Don't forget, if you like Murder Mile and you haven't done one yet, please do a review on any of the podcast platforms. Some of them you have to write things, you don't have to write much. In others, you just have to click star. You can click 5 stars and that'll be lovely. So thank you very much for that. Hope you're all having a good week. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.